Thank you for being with us for another edition of Political Rewind. So glad you could all join us. We got a little over 2 weeks to go until Election Day. Hard to believe it's coming around quite so quickly. Couple of quick items before I introduce the panel and we get started on topics. Number one, I'm told there you should still, if you want to see us in Savannah, we're going to be down there on Tuesday night, October 30th. At the Jewish Education Alliance. I think we're pretty close to being full, but I would go ahead and register if I were you, because we always lose people the night of an event, like most people do. So just go to gpb.org/community and you can sign up to save yourself a place to be with us in Savannah. Second, the governor candidates, gubernatorial candidates are here tomorrow night at the GPB studios in Midtown Atlanta for a debate, the Atlanta Press Club GPB debate. It should be a really interesting event. And on Wednesday's show, we're going to break it all down for you, of course. So we hope you'll join us for that. And finally, please know that on election night, we will be here starting with a TV show that will also be simulcast on the radio at 7 p.m. We'll do an hour on TV and radio simultaneously, and then starting a little after 8 we will be on the air on the radio, on the statewide network, until we have a resolution, particularly in the governor's race, unless it's going to take all night, in which case I'm going to get a little nap in. Aren't you, Galloway?
this is the day when it's the Wednesday after the election that becomes the hard one. Yeah. When you're trying to pull a full day off of 3 or 4 hours sleep.
And you, that's Jim Galloway, of course, the lead political writer for the AJC, and you have that odd additional issue, which I don't think it's like a secret to have to not talk about. You've got to file a column on Tuesdays on Election Day.
By 5 o'clock.
For Wednesday. So you've got that odd situation where you have to find something completely different to write about for your Wednesday paper.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out what to do for next week, but for week after next.
All right. Well, you can start talking about the 2020 cycle Republican Heath Garrett, who is with us today, pointed out that the 2020 cycle starts for Republicans basically
on November 7th.
November 7th, yeah.
No question about it. I mean, with the presidential cycle and with the what we call the perpetual political cycle now, the next day you get up and you start preparing for the next election.
All right. Heath Garrett, Republican strategist. Jim Galloway, lead political writer. Wednesdays and Sundays, his column appears in the paper. And, of course, he oversees the Political Insider blog at myajc.com. Your colleague, Tamar Hellerman, is with us from Washington. Tamar, thank you for joining us.
Heath is already starting to give me PTSD, and this election isn't even over yet.
Well, we're glad you could be with us today. Try to hold it together, Tamar.
I'll do my best.
And, of course, we're also really happy that Michael C. Owens, the chairman of the Cobb County Democratic Party, is with us today. You've had a big weekend up there in Cobb County, didn't you?
Yeah, we've probably for like the last three weekends, it's been all about the 6th District Task Force and what we're doing to try to get Lucy McBath elected. So, you know, we've had some pretty heavy hitters from the Democratic Party. We had former Governor Patrick Duvall.
Or Massachusetts.
Patrick, when Massachusetts was there, came in. We've had Martin O'Malley's came in. And last night we had Congressman James Clyburn came in.
From South Carolina.
Yes. Wow, right. That's a big gun right there.
Yeah. We're going to talk. Tamar just posted a story about Karen Handel and Lucy McBath in the Insider, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later in the show. She also did a piece on Rob Woodall and Carolyn Devereaux up there in the 7th District.
Bordeaux.
Maybe you're right, Tamar. Maybe PTSD is setting in. Carolyn Bordeaux. And we'll talk about both of those in a minute. But, Jim, we've been promising our listeners, because they've been really asking for this, and I think they're right to want to know, if we can talk a bit about the amendments that are everybody in the state has either already voted on or is going to vote on as the election continues. So let's go over them, okay?
All right.
And we don't have to take a ton of time on each of them, but there are a couple that are a little bit more controversial, perhaps a little more complicated. Amendment number one, land conservation, parks, and trails. Advocates on this lobbied for 10 years to persuade lawmakers to put this question before the voters. They're asking to set aside 80% of existing sales tax on sporting goods for conservation efforts. That would be about $200 million over the next decade, and it could be used for a variety of things, purchasing parkland, riverfront acreage, rural areas that where they want to preserve wildlife, that sort of thing.
Okay, and the story behind this amendment is the fact that we have all these special taxes, whether on sporting goods or the big one is tire disposal.
Right.
And they're supposed to be the tax is supposed to be for a specific purpose, but in fact it goes into the general fund and becomes just part of the great mass of $25, $26 billion that legislators appropriated. This gives, the environmentalists are saying this would give at least limited, it would put a limited restriction on the legislature on the use of the money.
All right. The people who might push back on this, Heath, are those who feel, the legislature's already approved all of these, obviously, or they wouldn't be on the ballot. So the presumption that supporters have is that if they approved it, they know money is in the budget to pay for it. But if there's any controversy about it, it's that this special tax, this $200 million, could go, say, for education or other purposes.
Right. This is the kind of amendment that gets fiscal conservatives actually divided with each other, right? Fiscal conservatives believe that it ought to be dedicated. If you promise it's going to be dedicated money, it needs to be dedicated. This amendment would do that, at least restrict it in a way that it hasn't been. But also, if you're trying to maintain a good balanced budget, you need more of these revenues in the general fund. And so by taking $200 million out and dedicating it, does not give legislators flexibility in good years or more importantly in bad years to move money around and balance our budget. So it's a nice little conflict there. But it is a feel-good amendment. You are dedicating money to more conservation. It's interesting to see Republicans getting into a middle-of-the-road issue like this, but I think that's where the dichotomy comes.
All right, so that's amendment number one. I don't think there's much more. It's pretty straightforward. Amendment number two is a little bit more complicated in terms of the controversy around it. Amendment number two is the Business Courts Amendment. It's being billed, according to the article in your paper, Jim, billed as a pro-business cost-saving measure. It would create statewide business courts. Judges in these courts would be appointed by the governor to five-year terms with the approval of legislative committees, the judiciary committees. They would not be elected. Now, so the justification for it, Jim, is that quite often, business cases can be very complicated and can take up a lot of time in superior courts that have a bigger docket to deal with. So that's one of the reasons that advocates wanted to see this pass.
Right, right. I haven't seen a whole lot of opposition from the Georgia trial lawyers on this thing, which am I right on that, Heath?
You're right. There's not opposition. They would have preferred that they be elected judges, but right. They're not opposing it, even though that didn't happen.
There's a pilot program going right now in Fulton and Gwinnett on these courts, and the idea is to get them out into the hinterland so you wouldn't have to travel to Atlanta to qualify for one of these things. As Heath said, it's the fact that this will be the first kind of brand of a state judge who is not subject to a popular vote.
And Michael, that is exactly what some people worry about with this, that you suddenly have judges who are appointed by the governor for five-year terms and then can be reappointed
as well
to that position. And their opponents are worried about setting up a situation like that.
Yeah, that's really been the only real strong opposition I've heard, whether it's through the trial lawyers and quite honestly, even on other levels and just people that's reached out and you see on social media that's had issues with it as they've read through it and go, wait a minute, it kind of sticks out. Wait, why are we appointing judges? So, if there's any real opposition, and I think that's what
it is. It would be a significant increase in the power of the governor, I think.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. No question about it. But I do think it's important. Remember, we're the number one state in the country to do business, and the reason why this came up is that as we've grown in size and in population, and we're the home to lots of Fortune 500 and Fortune 1000 companies, business and commercial litigation is so unique, and superior courts mostly are just overtaxed and overburdened. And so if you slow that down, the one ranking we don't do well in is what's our legal certainty for these businesses when they relocate to Georgia or they grow here. This would help in that regard and in respect. And I do think the check on the governor's power is the term limits and the fact that the governor's not reelected over and over and over again.
So. Well, Heath, you're a lawyer, so yes. You could help us with this. I think there's some concern. I don't know that it's shared by a large number of people in the legal community, and they're the ones who I think are most watchful in terms of this.
Yeah.
Does this create a court, especially with judges appointed by a governor, which could be seen to favor business, say, over consumer litigants who may have a case for some sort of consumer fraud or injury, liability of some sort? Right. And I think there is some concern about that.
Yeah, there's a limitation. So not all cases, right? If you're a consumer and you're going up against a corporation, you're going to still have the venue of superior court and other options in the state. This is really more business-to-business type of complex commercial litigation. So if it weren't that narrow, that would be a legitimate concern. But you're right. These are courts of expertise. There are states around the country where this has gone very well. Delaware is the reason why most companies are based in Delaware, is they have expert judges up there to deal with these kind of things. That would put Georgia on par with that and help us attract business. But yes, there need to be checks, but I think those checks are the legislature getting to certify the appointments. There are term limits, and then governors have term limits. So, at the ballot box, people can elect governors and state legislators.
Why did the legislation not just call for the judges to be elected?
Yeah, I'm guessing that the issue with that is, right, how do you then make sure they have the qualifications to be, experts in commercial complex litigation?
I mean, I would argue that a superior court judge who has to oversee complex criminal cases, you might want to guarantee that she or he has some expertise
in cases
like that as well.
Yeah. All right. By the way, Bill, this is a trend. We're going to start to see more drug courts. We'll probably start to see other specialty courts like veteran courts. Healthcare is probably another area where these things have gotten so outrageously complex.
Number three, I would be the first to tell you, I think Jim Galloway is the most complicated amendment for me to understand on the ballot. It has to do with a timber tax. So let me read what your folks said in writing about it in the Constitution. Large timberland owners have been receiving tax breaks since the state constitution, was amended in 2008, creating the Forest Land Protection Act. For almost a decade, the state has been sending millions of dollars to local school boards and county governments to make up a majority, that's 97%, of what they're not collecting in taxes from those property owners. Now, this amendment would allow local governments to be reimbursed at rates closer to a property's current values. Some local governments come out winners under that methodology. Some would be losers. So essentially, it's an effort to reimburse a local government
to give more revenue flow to local governments. It's kind of the root of this thing is the fact that this property is valued as forest and not as a crop.
Right.
And the other part of that is you have so many counties, especially down in South Georgia, that are almost nothing but timberland.
Michael, the CEO of the Georgia Forestry Association, says that a University of Georgia study shows that the state's working forest is taxed three times higher than in neighboring states, with 4.7 million acres taxed at rates about six times higher. So this is an effort to continue to keep the taxes on the timber farmers to a lower rate.
Yeah, right. And I mean, I've seen this firsthand traveling down to Quaker County, some other places in South Georgia, where as far as I could see, there's longleaf pines, and it is a full blown industry, right? It's not just land. I mean, you really have to view it more as crops.
All right, I do think I would urge you all, if Google this one, Because you're smart voters out there, we know you are. You may want to do a little bit more research on this timber tax and see what you think. Number four is the Crime Victims' Rights Amendment. It's also been known across the country, Heath, as Marzi's Law. What does it do?
Marzi's Law actually kind of codifies in the Constitution, right, the idea that victims have rights. You already have certain notice rights if you're a victim about hearings and court cases. But in this case, if you're the victim of a crime and that individual is getting out of jail or paroled or other types of notifications, it makes sure that it's in the Constitution that you will get some kind of notification and can be prepared. And you even have some rights to go back and ask that that not happen in certain cases or seek other types of protection. So emotionally, it tugs on your heartstrings. It was started by an individual who was familiar with a case in another state where someone wasn't notified.
This is a California billionaire.
Tamar, you've probably been hearing about it in Washington because there are many states that are passing versions of Marzi's Law. It all relates back to Marzi Nicholas, a young woman in California who was murdered. And within the week after the murder took place, Marzi's family walked into a store and saw the guy who'd been arrested for her killing walking free. And they were stunned to find this out. So, Tamar, this is a big national campaign, as Jim says, funded by money from one billionaire out there.
Yeah, and it's something that I've started to see pop up in some of our less contentious congressional races. I think a lot of the Republicans especially see this as an easy way to kind of rally support.
But I will tell you, Bill, the ACLU has pushed back very, very hard on this bill. Because what its main point being that victims' rights, they're asking for the creation of a relationship between victims and the state that would directly contradict a lot of the relationship between an accused, a mm-hmm. perpetrator, and the state, and If you talk to a lot of lawyers, they're saying this is not a place you want to go. And what's more, it's as you said, a lot of this stuff is already in statute, and we're putting it into the Constitution. That's a bad habit.
Yeah, one of the things, Michael, that the critics have said is basically what Galloway just pointed out. It's that you suddenly allow the victims or the victim's family to be involved in a court proceeding. You would not be able to seat the mother of an assault victim, a murder victim, on the jury. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's forbidden by law. The critics suggest that there's some similarity when you allow the family to enter into court proceedings and therefore become part of essentially the criminal justice system.
That is part of the concern. I mean, it literally spells it out, and it says, you know, that the rights for the victims would inclusion of any scheduled court appearances and the opportunity to be heard at any scheduled proceedings involving the release, plea, or sentencing of the accused. So it puts them right there, right in the middle of it.
Tamar, you've got to figure that the language of this amendment, Heath already basically said it, is such that there's no chance in the world this isn't going to pass. Giving the families of victims of crime rights to be involved. This is why the way in which a constitutional amendment is written has a lot to do with how people perceive it, right, Tamar?
Exactly. And that's why we have programs like Political Rewind that talk about that.
All right.
You're totally right.
Real quick, the last one is an amendment, number five, and the amendment's kind of, Jim, it's pretty straightforward. Basically, what number five says is that if you have a school district that has a city school system within the county, so in DeKalb County, you have the Decatur school system. Right. In Cobb County, you have Marietta. And it basically said, it used to be that you'd have to have separate agreement on each system.
If a county is seeking a school SPLOST, then it has to get the permission of both the countywide school system and the city school system, which often leaves it gives a great deal of leverage to that smaller system. And I think if I'm not mistaken, I think one of the main backers of this amendment was Lindsay Tippins out in Marietta.
Yes.
And he did not, you know, he didn't appreciate the larger Cobb County school system being held hostage by the Marietta system.
I want to be careful about how we share this with our listeners, Heath, because I believe this removes the requirement that a county system and a city school district have to agree before calling for a referendum. It removes that necessary agreement.
That's right. That's right, which gave the smaller system a lot of leverage, mm-hmm. right, over the larger system.
Sure.
And not just in Cobb County or Marietta, but also in smaller communities all around. There are about 20, I think there are 20 systems left, independent city systems.
Like Lawrence in Dublin. And
Dublin and I guess maybe Gainesville, and you've got a few others around the state that do that. And so it gave them a tremendous amount of leverage, and a few of them abused at times that leverage. And even though they represented 30% of the revenue of the county, they might have wanted 40 or 50% mm-hmm. after the tax was collected. And so the larger counties, you know, kind of rightfully. So I think this would be a good one, you know, to support, because it does. There were certain examples where they weren't getting the votes done because people were holding things up.
Mike? I just wanted to kind of take a step back, just kind of based on some of the questions that I get about these ballot questions as a whole, is that the fact that, you know, they're statewide, number one, right? And that they've already gone through the House and the Senate, had 2/3 of approval. So lots of questions about that from people.
All right. Tell you what we're going to do. We're going to take a break right now. There's some statewide referenda on the ballots as well, but that's enough of looking at these ballot issues today. Before Election Day, we'll look at those couple of referenda. They're pretty, Jim. They're pretty in the weeds.
In the weeds, and I haven't studied up on them
yet. Yeah, me neither. All right, let's do this. Let's take a break, and when we come back, let's talk about some news that's coming out of our 2018 election cycle.
Peter Sagal here, and if you're in your car, I want you to try something. Roll up the windows. You're all sealed inside. Take a good smell. Can you smell that? That was the great cologne experiment of 2004. You should not have gone with the dollar store for that one. Well, you can lose that old car smell by donating your vehicle to one of your favorite causes, like public radio. It only takes a few minutes, and just like that, you've supported the station, and well, you are on your way to a life of better smells.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. A quick clarification. Tom Faust told me during the break that I got it wrong. I'm always the last to learn these things. But on election night, from 7 to 8, we will be on television and streaming on Facebook. We won't go on the radio statewide until after 8 o'clock. So join us at 7 on GPB TV or on Facebook Live. You know what? Tamara, you have not had to get involved in too much of the business of this show yet. Let's talk about the congressional races before we talk about some updates in the.
Let's make it hard on Tamara.
Yeah, let's make Tamara work a little for the big money she gets on this show. Tamara, you filed two pieces on the 6th and 7th district races, and I want to talk about them with you and the panel. First of all, you just filed, to the best of my knowledge, within the last few hours, a piece on the 6th district congressional race, Lucy McBath and Karen Handel. What did you report about the NRCC, the National Republican Congressional Committee?
Sure. So after last year's special election, where all these outside groups were pouring in millions and millions of dollars into the North Atlanta suburbs, we really weren't seeing a lot of that this year, with the big exception of Every Town for Gun Safety, which is where Lucy McBath used to work. But now today we finally got word that House Republicans, their campaign arm from Washington, they're finally going to be entering the race in favor of Karen Handel. And that suggests they might be a little bit worried about her odds next month. And I talked to them. They say they're just shoring stuff up, making sure Karen Handel's going to win. But it certainly does raise some interesting questions about where they think the race is.
I think you reported they put about $1.5 million into the campaign.
Exactly. So these are going for television ads that we're going to see for the next 2 weeks through the election day. And that's a pretty big investment for them.
Yeah, and tomorrow, I mean, you don't get the TV feed here, but you know, if you were sitting in front of your, if you happened to be sitting in front of your TV set yesterday watching football, what you noticed was that Lucy McBath was just inundating the airwaves, and I would say at least 4-1 against opposite Karen Handel. Karen Handel didn't have the presence on TV this weekend, and it was very telling.
Yeah, McBath has been able to raise a ton of money over the last few months, but she's been just shoveling into television ads to help get her name ID up. Karen Handel, of course, everyone knows who she is after last year's race, but she has been at a bit of a fundraising disadvantage this year. So this effort from the House Republican campaign arm certainly will help her.
So, Michael, that's your territory.
Yeah, I mean, Lucy raised almost $1 million in the last reporting quarter, so that's nothing at all to sneeze at. And quite frankly, from a Republican standpoint, they're not going to put $1 million in this race at the last minute if they don't feel it's necessary.
Yeah, right? I do think that's interesting, Heath, because what we heard just last week was that the NRCC was backing out of districts that they'd already given up as being lost. So the fact that they're in this race, they've got some extra money because they backed out of races they figured they can't win anyway.
Right.
And they must see 6th District as being at least somewhat competitive.
Yeah,
yes?
No, I'll put a couple of points on that. I think they were able to back out of some races they didn't think they could win. They were also able to get money out of races where the Democratic Congressional Committee pulled out because they didn't think they could win again.
Right.
So there is new money on the table. They've raised a ton of money out of the 6th District because of the heightened sensitivity. And there's no question, look, the outside money for the Democrats have a money advantage, right? Any idea that Republicans are spending more money in Georgia this year is wiped out. We're going to be outspent by the Democrats nationally in Georgia by maybe as much as $10 or $15 million by the time this is over with. So the NRCC coming in actually shores up an area where Democrats have focused their grassroots attention. Michael's been doing a good job out there in the 6th District of getting voters out of the polls. And so I think the NRCC recognizes that we got to make sure we have people coming to the polls on the 6th District to make sure it stays stable where it normally would be, which is with Karen getting 53% to 55% of the vote. That'll help Brian Kemp. That'll help Republicans and other ballots. If we don't match it in that area, then we could end up with
Michael Heath Garrett, 53% to 55% of the vote for Karen Handel.
Look, the fact of the matter is, who's on the ground putting in the work, knocking on the doors, I'm proud of the effort that's going on there. So it's definitely a challenging race. So it's one that I can understand why Republicans are continuing to put money into it.
Yeah, no question. A lot of money being spent there, a lot of ground game. It's as much, in my mind, this is as much about a battle for 2020 and 2022 out there. And so Republicans are going to have to step up our grassroots game in order to keep up with the machine that's being built.
You know, Jim, we always get frustrated when we don't have at least something of a map with polling on races like this. But it's hard for independent polling, to do independent polling of a congressional race like this.
I think Heath and other poll savvy people will tell you that the congressional polling is among the hardest to do and thus the most expensive.
Yeah. And so while we have internals, the McBath people put out a poll not long ago or told us that they were doing very, very well in their own internal polling. But we have no way of knowing exactly what's happening up there in either the 6th or the 7th.
No. And I think at this point, those two congressional races and the race for governor are so intertwined right now that it would be really hard to pull them apart.
All right.
Now, I was just going to say in the 7th race there's a pretty remarkable difference there because Carolyn Bordeaux, she did raise $1 million. Over $1 million, and I think Rob Woodall had only raised 280,000, somewhere around there, a little less than 300,000. So she comes in this down the stretch, with a lot more money, 820,000 compared to his 500,000.
Yeah, but okay, go ahead, Jim.
No, I was going to say again. It was Football Sunday, and you did see a lot of Carolyn Bordeaux ads, and not a whole lot of Rob Woodall ads.
Okay,
and
but
that's interesting.
There are no Rob Woodall ads. Yeah, that's the difference.
And one thing I would like
to say about the Karen Handel money coming in from Washington is that equally notable is the fact that this money is not going to help Rob Woodall in the 7th, which it has me asking questions. What are they seeing in their polls?
But I'm sorry, Tamara, but you had one of the most I know you don't write the headlines, but you write the copy. And I thought you had a piece this week that was one of the most intriguing headlines of the week. And I can't quote it verbatim, but essentially it said why Rob Woodall isn't worried about his race in the 7th District this time around. Yes?
Exactly. His folks have been emanating confidence this whole time. And I kept saying, look, this, you know, Carolyn Bordeaux's raising so much money. She's getting all these people coming in. You're really not nervous. And they always said, no, no, no. And they sent out an internal poll the other day that showed them up by 27 points. You know, this is an internal poll. Those should all be taken with, you know, a bunch of grains of salt. But between that, they point to vote totals from the primaries back in May that showed there were about 10, 15,000 more Republican voters. They feel between that and Woodall's name ID that they can, you know, that they're sitting pretty.
We don't. Heath, you really think that he's that far ahead in that district?
Well, there's no question that her name recognition is just now starting. If there's a poll with that kind of gap, it was because she didn't have any name recognition in the district. But however, the generic Democrat's going to do a lot better than that when it comes to Election Day here over the last couple of weeks. That district is fundamentally a little better for a Republican than the 6th District, just by demographics and Republican voter age population normally. And number two, it did not have the battle for the 6th District last year. So the 6th District is much more organized by the Democrats than the 7th. I'm not saying the 7th's not been organized, but you had $40 million spent last year in the 6th District organizing it for Democrats. That hadn't happened up there. And then the other thing, Rob Woodall's a good friend. We were in law school together. He is a very hard worker on the ground. And he came out of nowhere to win the primary in 2010. And he ran that district for John Linder beforehand. He knows that district probably better than anybody else. I think they're quietly confident. I don't think they should get overconfident. But there's no question that I think he's doing better out there against a generic Democrat at this point.
Michael, I assume that on election night, we will be waiting quite a while to hear what happens in both of those races, because you're talking about big suburban areas, counties. Those votes tend to come in a little later in the evening. Are you prepared for a long night up there?
I think it's going to be a long night. I know that as far as the county and election boards are going, they're preparing for it. They've already been preparing for pretty big numbers. They've actually upped the number of people that they're going to have actually at the polls tallying and everything. So I expect a long night, but I'm expecting to, have some champagne.
All right. Let's move to the governor's race. There's lots of news in the governor's race. The thing that happened most recently was at about 11 o'clock this morning, Stacey Abrams went and voted early. Here's what she told reporters when she came out.
I usually vote on election day. It's the way that's the way I grew up. It's the way my parents raised us. You go vote on election day. But I know that in a time when people are concerned about whether their ballots will be counted, if we vote early, we can guarantee that people have time to correct any mistakes, to deal with any concerns. And if we vote early, we can bank our votes and we will know by election day where we stand. And that's why I'm so excited about voting early, especially here at the People's Mall in South DeKalb.
Jim, she said it. I usually vote on election day. Not this year. I'm going out early. And I wonder what else is in the heads of the campaign that they believe they should be. Wow. Not quite sure what that. Oh, that's Tamar's got police sirens. They're after her. Jim, why vote? You know, I wonder if she wants to just really pump up the Democratic vote.
Well,
early.
There's two messages there. Number one, go vote.
Yeah.
And number two, be very careful and make sure that vote is counted. I mean, this is you know, look, if Brian Kemp's closing message is going to be beware the illegal immigrants who come to vote, she's going to be her message is going to be make sure they don't toss aside your ballot.
Yeah.
I think it's been something we've continued to say in all these efforts around whether your vote's going to count or you know, are you going to be rejected or something? The thing is, get out there early, go vote, vote provisional if you can. And if there's a problem, you have some opportunity to fix it. But there's also the thing that, you know, things come up. And if you wait till election day, you know, you could actually have an opportunity to vote not to count. But I will tell you, I get lots of calls and you know, nice old ladies will call and, you know, I'll say, well, ma'am, this is where your polling location is. And You know, you can actually go vote, you know, on Monday. And she goes, oh, no, I'm voting on Election Day.
Yeah, sure.
Right? So we're still going to see, you know, these surge of voters come out on Election Day. And so I don't know that we can still, even at the end of early voting, you know, we can look at this, but know that we're still going to have a good turnout on Election Day.
You know, I was just looking at the early voting returns that as of the end of business on Friday, and you've still got, and I wondered if this was another reason that Stacey Abrams went to South DeKalb Mall to vote early. You've now got, you're hovering at almost 30%, a little under 30% black turnout early, 29.7 or so.
Yeah,
she'd love to get that number up before Election Day.
She needs to get that number up by the end of the day on November 6th.
Exactly.
That number needs to be 31, 32.
All right. Meanwhile, Brian Kemp, who's about to go off on this big bus tour around the state, he's been back in rural Georgia, but he's going to launch an official tour fairly soon. I'm not quite sure exactly when, Heath, but it's coming.
Yeah, I think it kicks off on Sunday or Monday, right after Georgia, Florida.
In the meantime, Jim had a couple of really positive developments for him. Number one, over the weekend, the president went back on Twitter and renewed his calls for the people of Georgia to vote for Brian Kemp as the best candidate for governor. And that certainly helped Brian in the runoff. But then, and you'll tell me about this, Jim, the even bigger one was this commercial.
This election is about Georgia's future. We can't afford billions in big government with higher taxes. Brian Kemp is the only candidate who will keep Georgia moving forward. Brian is a businessman who will grow our economy and create jobs by investing in education and a skilled workforce. And Brian will keep Georgia safe and strong. I'm Nathan Deal. Brian Kemp will keep Georgia moving in the right direction.
Jim, it's nice to have the president, but in Georgia, having Nathan Deal special.
That's important, and you'll notice that that commercial was very nonspecific. It was very, very vague. It let the governor say what he wanted, exactly what he wanted to say there. This is, if you are a Democrat in Georgia, this is where the vice starts to tighten. We're in the last 2 weeks, and here, and now the full weight of Republican influence begins to kind of come down on your campaign. Yes, we saw Trump enter the race over the weekend. I mean, but 8 years ago, it was George W., or maybe a little bit more than
Years ago.
Ten years ago, it was George W. This is we talk about this period when the Republican base comes home, and we're at the front door of that period right now.
Tamar, let me just pick up on something Jim said, though. I mean, I get that, you know, Trump's popularity, according to the AJC polling, and it may have changed since the last poll, which was a week plus ago, hovering right around 50%. I would argue that that in many ways, Nathan Deal, who is enormously popular, is a bigger endorsement right now than Donald Trump.
Yeah, and Nathan Deal in all of our polling over the last few years has proven to be the most popular Republican in Georgia, more so than Trump, more so than Sonny Perdue or any other kind of official. So that definitely means a lot. At the same time, if, you know, Republicans have been so nervous about their base not wanting to come out this election. And I think the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation really galvanized folks. And I think there still is quite a bit of hope that Trump will show up in Georgia over the next 2 weeks to campaign for Kemp.
Michael, Stacey Abrams has made a point over and over again of saying that, and she, because obviously she gets how popular Nathan Deal is with Republicans and Democrats, of saying how she worked with Nathan Deal in the legislature, especially on criminal justice reform. Does this take any of the wind out of her sails in trying to argue that she really is the inheritor of the Deal legacy in some ways?
I mean, I don't think so. I mean, there's no surprise at the end of the day, you know, Republican governor is going to come out and endorse the Republican nominee. So there's no surprise there. But Abrams has been consistent in what she said is how she's been able to work across the aisle and how her campaign is basically out there for all Georgias. You know, so I don't see a surprise in it.
I tell you what, Heath, if you tell me the one thing that I did looking at that ad and listening to it just a few minutes ago, the softness of that ad makes me feel that it's directed at women voters.
There's no question, right? First of all, Bill, you're right. It was a powerful 1-2 punch. Nobody can motivate base Republican voters in the state of Georgia better than Donald Trump when it comes to tweets and getting stuff out for the base. And we know that the Democrats are organized and coming to vote in historic numbers already. So that was important. But Nathan Deal, I do think, is probably the linchpin of the campaign because that ad goes right to – it's independent women and independent men. Jim, you know, we forget there are a lot of independent voter men, and Nathan Deal is speaking right to both independent men and independent women. There are Nathan Deal Democrats still out there in the state of Georgia, and they like him. You know, the state is clear in all polling that the majority of Georgians think Georgia's going in the right direction, and I think that's why he ends the ad with that line. Brian Kemp will keep us going in the right direction. It's a nice, very not so subtle handoff from one person to the next, and it helps smooth over any of the rough edges that some people think Brian Kemp still has.
I don't think we should fail to mention, Jim, that Nathan Deal was reluctant to jump into. He certainly didn't want to jump in on behalf of Casey Cagle. He was on the stage with Brian Kemp at a big Republican rally the night or two after Kemp won the runoff. But he's been relatively quiet so far in this campaign.
No, I mean, the higher politics, he got caught up in the higher politics. He came out and endorsed Cagle, I think, with a statement. Yeah. And then he was immediately bigfooted by the Purdue cousins who were able to bring Trump in.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's do this. Let's get another break out of the way, because when we come back, Brian Kemp, in an op-ed piece that he wrote in the Sunday Atlanta Journal-Constitution, made a claim that I think deserves our attention and our scrutiny. You're listening to Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, Melissa McCarthy.
Quite by accident, I find myself in a rather criminal position.
McCarthy stars in the new film, Can You Ever Forgive Me?, as a biographer turned literary forger. We'll talk about the film, growing up on a farm, her early comedy act, her role in Bridesmaids, and playing Sean Spicer on Saturday Night Live. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB and gpbnews.org.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. As we get into the Kemp campaign, let's very quickly listen to a big name who has been here today campaigning on behalf of Brian Kemp. Marco Rubio was in Cobb County, I think, this morning, and then went over to Fulton, into the city of Atlanta, right, Jim?
Right, right. Two appearances in Cobb.
Let's listen to what Rubio had to say.
And you've heard about all the money pouring in. You know why all that money pours in from all over the country? Because they want to nationalize these races. They want to make these races about what's happening everywhere else except here. But it's about here. Because when the election's over, everybody picks up and goes on to another campaign somewhere else. But you still live here. And your children will still live here. And your children and grandchildren's future will be here. That's what you're trying to build through this campaign. And it won't matter if you don't vote.
Marco Rubio. Okay, Tamar, I don't mean to be a skeptic, but this is a Republican talking about Democrats trying to nationalize the campaign when Donald Trump is going from rally to rally saying a vote for so-and-so is a vote for me.
And also a national figure who ran for president, coming in. You know, it's par for the course,
of course
though.
I mean, that's...
And now we've seen so many kind of celebrity endorsements and people swing through for, you know, both sides in all these races. I don't think anybody bats an eyelash at this point.
All right. Jim, let's go into this op-ed piece that the AJC ran yesterday. Brian Kemp wrote a piece. You're here in your role as a writer for the paper. You are not here as a member, because you're not, of the editorial board, nor do you make decisions for the editorial page.
This is correct.
Let's not talk. But in setting this up, I do think it's fair to say, and Michael, you can comment on this, the Abrams campaign, so Kemp had an op-ed piece yesterday. The Abrams campaign put out wrote a letter to the AJC this morning and said, hey, you told us earlier in the campaign that Kemp and Abrams were each going to get one opportunity to do an op-ed piece. And all of a sudden, without telling us anything about it and offering us another opportunity, Brian Kemp has a second op-ed in the paper. The answer we understand, or we're told, is, well, he's Secretary of State. He's getting a lot of accusations for voter suppression, whatever.
And I believe there was an opposing view from Raphael Warnock.
Yes, there was. Raphael Warnock of Ebenezer Baptist Church, who's becoming a bigger and bigger player in Democratic politics, did respond. So thank you for that, Jim. Okay, that said, Jim, one of the things that Kemp says in his editorial, he's repeating an allegation he's been making for the last week or so, and that is that Stacey Abrams is encouraging undocumented residents of Georgia, illegals in his words, to go to the polls and vote. And in the op-ed piece, he points to page 50 of the New Georgia Project, which was Stacey Abrams' effort to get new voters registered. Page 50 contains the language that makes it clear.
But he doesn't tell you what's on page 50, does
I
he?
Sent a note to the Kemp campaign at noon or so yesterday saying, I'd love to hear your interpretation of what this language, how this language leads you to believe that she's telling illegal residents to vote. And, of course, they didn't respond, which I'm disappointed in.
Okay, basically, this is the lawsuit, that the federal lawsuit challenging the 53,000 registered voters who have been placed in a pending status by the Secretary of State's office because their voting information, their voting registration information doesn't match up with either the driver's license database of the state or their last four digits don't match up with what's in the Social Security Administration has. And it's often, you know, it's often a you know, it's often an input mistake. In asking the judge for redress, the plaintiffs ask for election officials to be ordered to, if a naturalized citizen has already shown proof of citizenship, that they be relieved from having to show it again and again and again. That's what that paragraph that he points to says. It has nothing to do with illegal immigration.
The
lawsuit has been updated, it's been revised, and it's the portion that Kemp is pointing to is now on page 54.
Yeah,
and it emphasizes that it is addressed at people who are inaccurately accused of being non-citizen voters.
So Heath, is this just you know, partisan politics at work? Do you believe, I guess the question is, do you believe the Abrams campaign really is trying to get undocumented residents to the polls?
Look, she has a combination of things. I think she may have been inarticulate last week when she talked about the blue wave and we're going to win because all these people are going to come vote for us, and she included undocumented.
No, she didn't say
she
vote.
She didn't say vote.
She did not use the word vote, but it was clear that we're going to win with the blue wave. So what are we going to allow illegal aliens to do?
You know, I've talked about the blue wave over and over again, and you know, the blue wave is about these principles and ideals and values that we're standing on as Democrats, and that's what's driving us out, not just to the polls, but it's what's driving us out to talk to other Democrats and knock on doors to volunteer to be engaged. So, you know, we all heard the piece, right?
Yeah.
And what she said. But there's many aspects of being part of that blue wave. You start off with the 800,000 DACA students that's in this country, right?
And I agree. That's why I said it was inarticulate. I think I know what she meant to be saying, but she said it in a way that's fair play in a political campaign. And then you have in the lawsuit language, Jim, which I disagree. I read the language, and I actually believe that if read strictly the way that the plaintiffs for Stacey Abrams group wrote it, if you were pending status and you are not a citizen, they are asking, it says, all provisional ballots cast by folks in this pending status to be counted. And so it's a straight-faced legal argument, and then I think the reason why their lawyers moved it.
But the next paragraph says, ask the judge to require election officials to enforce a strict protocol that when voters are flagged as non-citizen by DDS or produce no match from the DDS or SSA databases, before contacting the voter about the issue, registrars must check the initial registration. If proof of citizenship or identity was provided, voters should mark those requirements as met.
And as we understand it, that was added after
the complaint by Kemp. That's part of the original.
That was original.
But the same point, the language is you do these things. So as a lawyer, let's talk about how each different segment, you can always point to them, but if a judge doesn't. So these are straight-faced legal arguments that can be made by both sides, right? She raised the voter suppression. He's fighting back. And she's using loose language, acting like people are not – or nobody's done more to register more voters in the state of Georgia than Brian Kemp.
Yeah, we've said over and over.
Suppression.
There's no question that this whole battle is being fought out over the whole issue of who gets to vote and who doesn't. Mm-hmm. So I want to do two things. One, we have pointed out on this show many times that during his tenure as Secretary of State, Kemp did enable people to be able to register much more easily, which doesn't necessarily counter Democratic arguments about potential or possible voter suppression. But rather than get into that right now, I want to listen once more, because Tom and Robert found it. Here's exactly what Stacey Abrams said last week about the blue wave.
We are 28 days from real change.
Yes. 28 days.
28 days before we tell Georgia who we are.
Yes.
And when we change Georgia, we change the South.
Yes.
And when we change the South, we change America.
Yes.
And that change starts right here.
Yes.
Because the thing of it is, blue waves aren't blue. That's what we use, because that's the color that we embrace.
Right.
But the thing of it is, a blue wave is African American.
Yeah.
It's white, it's Latino, it's Asian Pacific Islander.
Yes.
It is disabled.
Yes.
It is differently abled.
Yes.
It is LGBTQ.
Yes.
It is law enforcement.
Yes.
It is veterans.
Yes.
It is made up of those who've been told that they are not worthy of being here.
Yes.
It is comprised of those who are documented and undocumented.
Yes.
So for whatever it's worth, Tamar, I have to tell you, this is just me and my role as sort of this neutral, I hope, arbiter. I find that the arguments that Stacey Abrams is trying to encourage undocumented people to vote, and that there is necessarily proof positive of voter suppression, although there are many examples of why people might think there are, neither to my personal sense of satisfaction has been particularly well proven at this point, Tamar.
Sure, but I mean, think about where we are in the election cycle, right? This is the final 2 weeks of the race. Both, you know, you want to get your bases out. Talk about two issues that animate your core voters on either side. For Brian Kemp's people, it's the issue of immigration and this idea that there are all these, you know, illegal immigrants who could be voting. On the left, it's this idea of voter suppression. We've seen a ton of headlines all over the country about, you know, all the stuff that's happening in Georgia. So talk about great issues for each side to capitalize
and
on.
And they are issues that we will be able to continue talking about in the next couple of weeks. And if you want to talk about voter suppression, I'm all for it. I'd like to continue having that debate, as well as debates on the other side of the issue, too. Tamar Hallerman, Jim Galloway, Michael Owens, Heath Garrett, thanks for being here today. We're back tomorrow at 2 o'clock. And remember, tomorrow night at 7, the gubernatorial debate right here on GPB TV.